Let me ask you something. Are your teachers complaining because they're struggling managing their classrooms? Does it seem as though your students are more disconnected than ever, no matter how many engaging strategies you throw at them? Here's the truth. We are facing a massive classroom management crisis in education today. And for whatever reason, no one is talking about it. But what if there was a proven system, not a one-off workshop, not a trendy buzzword, but a mindset shift that rewires how your staff thinks about student connection, student discipline, and behavior management before things spiral out of control? Today, I sat down with David Brown and Steve McMahon from Mindset Safety Training, two of the sharpest voices in the game today, and they are going to help me break it all down. If you are a school leader, a teacher, or anyone wondering why the old rules aren't working anymore, and you want to know what you can do to fix it, this episode is your blueprint. Let's jump in. Okay, you guys, we are here with Steve and David from Mindset. I'm going to start firing some questions away at you guys. I hope you're all right with that. And I'm going to put you on a little bit of a hot seat. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling typical, Joe, because we've talked quite a few times, and it always seems like I'm on a hot seat when I'm talking with you.
I love you guys.
I'm just happy to be here.
I love it. All right, Steve, I'm going to start with you, okay? And okay. We're going to start with a bit of a personal journey. I want my listeners to know who you guys are, the brains behind Mindset. And so let me backtrack a little bit. Not all the brains behind the Mindset, but... yeah. Steve, I know your path started after serving in the Navy, correct?
That is correct, yeah.
What led you to education and eventually taking place in founding Mindset?
Great question, Joe, because I went in the Navy primarily to get out of town. I was one of those kids in high school that needed to get out of town, if you can follow my lead with that, right? So, you know, the Navy was a great opportunity for me in 1979 to leave a little town in upstate New York. Got to travel a little bit of the world and see things. And while I was in the Navy, I got invested in working with the human services realm because I worked with the Chaplains Corps. And so after that, I went to college. And I went to college thinking, I'm going to become somewhat of a youth minister, going to go down the road of working within the church. And after a few years of that journey, I really was kind of disgruntled with the idea of working in the church because those kids have a lot of support for the most part. And those kids had a lot of family members for the most part. And those kids had a lot of people on there behind them, you know. And I went to my college professor one day and I simply said, you know, I love working with kids, but I don't think I need to work in the realm of the church. I need to work with kids who are more like I was when I was growing up, which was a kid who was kind of wild, if you will. And so he said, you need to be in public school. You need to be a public school teacher because that's where they all are. Huh. And that's the beginning of it all. So I became a public school teacher and immediately was drawn to working with kids with specific needs relative to behavior. At that time, the state of Georgia, where I live and where I went to school, had an initiative to bring in more special education teachers. And so they had an initiative where you could get your master's degree and they would pay for it. So I was like, yeah, that's for me. So I went into the realm of special ed, was recruited then to work for a public school that actually served children with specific severe emotional and behavior disorders. And I stayed in that realm for, 9 years, seven as a teacher and two as an administrator.
That's interesting. Let me just ask a quick follow-up, Steve, because something similar happened to me, but my question to you is, if you had not been given an incentive for special education, would you have picked something different?
No, I would not have survived as a general education teacher.
Interesting.
Because my skill set was along the lines of dealing with kids with severe behavior issues anyway.
Okay.
There was a level of compassion and empathy that was natural to me because it's what I needed as a kid. And I remember several teachers coming alongside of me as a student when I was in school also and being that person for me.
Okay.
And so, you know, I wasn't driven to become a teacher for the sake of promoting academic excellence. I was driven to become a teacher for promoting emotional wellness.
I love it. What an answer. All right. What a start. Good job, you guys.
So
good job. All right. David, I'm going to pivot to you for a second.
All right.
You've worked hands-on in classrooms and now train educators across the country. What moment did you realize that this work was your calling? Because you are phenomenal at it.
Yeah, Joe, I think a lot of us who are doing this kind of work, it goes way back to childhood. You know, there was a lot of struggle on in early life of really struggling with the feelings of belonging and safety, you know, and then moving into, you know, you get into that early adulthood, you're 18, 19, and there's an opportunity in my community to work at a local shelter for abused kids, newborn to 17. And I was doing some work there while I was, you know, doing my undergraduate work, trying to figure out who I was. And, you know, it was very, you know, very, it was a beautiful place. It was a very safe place for kids, but, you know, they had already been through, you know, a lot of pretty tremendous trauma. And so I remember even then thinking about, you know, it doesn't have to be this way, but I didn't exactly, you know, have all the answers, you know? So then you go through university and you start, I worked at a long-term residential facility, you know, for mental health, and it was a therapeutic center, and that, again, continue looking for, you know, how do we not get here? It doesn't have to be this. Well, so what does it need to be? And it was when I was working at that residential center that, you know, Marshall Seiler came and trained us in what we called then PMAB, that eventually formed into mindset and the work that we do. And it clicked immediately. And it's, you know, I was able to, you know, hear it and it feels good, but then you go and do it and it works. And all of a sudden, all these other things that you've learned of control, enforcing, compliance, that sort of thing, all of a sudden now it became a practice and conversation that I've been practicing now for several decades. And I'm still working on getting better at it. You know, it's I've grown, but I don't think anybody can ever perfect it. But I've had some really beautiful moments with it, and it's become a passion there in the school district, using it in my classroom. And the people would come by and say, how are you working with those kids? How are you having this success? And it really boils down to those relationships and the way they're formed through the mindset curriculum.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so then it was a no-brainer to train it for my district. And then it was really a no-brainer to try to spread that across the country.
Yeah. I mean, it's that you guys have such a natural and organic connection to what you're doing. It's refreshing. I have to say that. Okay, I'm going to throw this out to you guys. For those unfamiliar, how would you describe mindset safety management in, let's say, a sentence or two?
Mindset safety management is all about making intentional connections with dysregulated individuals to help them become what they need to be in order to make proper decisions for their life.
I've got a sentence. Can I try a sentence?
Yeah, because that was a good
response.
One.
When disruptive behaviors occur, it's the response of staff which determines whether or not we're going to end up in a conversation or a confrontation. That was that's a quote by my friend Steve there.
I love that sticker.
It's become our it's a sticker. It's in our manual. It's on our slideshows. It's on our website. When I came up with that statement during a training one time, and I said to somebody in the training, somebody write that down real quick, because that's the essence of everything that we try to teach.
I mean, it really is.
Behavior happens, man. It happens every day, every moment of every day, right in front of us.
Yeah.
And we determine how that's going to wind up based on the way we respond to it.
Gosh, it's such a good point, a conversation or a confrontation. And for anybody listening, whether you're a teacher or an administrator, you should understand the difference between the two could be a minute detail. Usually,
Joe, may I interrupt for a second?
Please
say this.
Because please.
Since you brought that up, talking to the school leaders and whatnot, this is nothing new. This is nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. We've just taken great neurobiological information, counseling theories, but really it goes deeper than that, because a long time ago someone wrote that a gentle answer turns away wrath and harsh words stir up anger, and that was from Solomon in the book of Proverbs.
Holy moly.
So you're not doing anything that's brand new. We're just trying to translate these deep-seated truths. And now the interesting thing is that brain science has backed up everything that we've taught for the past 30 years.
Yeah. hopefully we can make a short out of that and send it out to the world, because I think they need to understand that a little bit better.
Well, it's really important when you talk about the old wisdom and people from, you know, obviously there's researchers in the world of behavior and emotional regulation, that sort of thing. But you go back to, you know, a quote that I really like by Viktor Frankl. He's talking about the space between stimulus and response. And he's saying in that space, there's a power to choose our response. And that response, in that response lies our growth and our freedom. And so, yes, something happens and how we respond to it, but there's something in between.
Yeah.
And that's where we focus. We focus not on the big picture, but in the moment. And it's been very powerful, because obviously life is a series of those moments, right?
Yeah.
You put them together in a beautiful life. It's not that there's an absence of bad, but there's a really challenge to have that practice and discipline in forming our responses. And that's why we spend so much work on asking people to be proactive in their planning and in their thinking.
So when you think about how we label our work, right, it's mindset safety management. And we think of safety in light of culture and climate, and helping people understand that the potential for dysregulation is within every one of us, whether that be a child or an adult. And so if we have a common language and a common belief system based on guiding principles that we teach, from promoting choice and trust, avoiding power struggles, you know, seeking proaction versus reaction, will ultimately set up everyone for success.
Huh. I got to tell you, it's going to be the responsibility of this show to make sure that as many people as possible are hearing what you guys are saying. It is.
Well, again, it's nothing new. It's just, we say it different.
And I feel like you say it right. You say it right. You know?
We can empower school districts to allow local administrators within buildings to create a culture and a climate of compassion and care. You know, and we believe, and I think research will show, that when you have a culture and a climate that's built on compassion and care and empathy, is your like the likely outcome will be academic achievement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I think it's really important, though, you know, when organizations bring us in, there's other organizations that create programming and products that talk about similar things that what we talk about, but we don't feel like we're selling a product. We're bringing, what we're doing is we're coming in, we're talking about a system of connection. Mm-hmm. It's very much a tier one level. And so what we're talking about is coaching people through systems and processes. Yes, there's things to do, but we focus on a lot to how to be in that moment. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, other than just us and our personalities and our experience and our walk, but the way we deliver mindset safety management and help people roll that out is a very explicit difference in a lot of what's already out there today. So it's not new. Steve's right. It's not new, but how we do it is fairly unique.
And you know, David, I want to follow up to that one, because you're correct there. And I was going to ask, what do you think sets you guys apart from the other programs? Do you feel as though it's your interaction, your day-to-day, your focus on the process of the culture and the climate of the schools that is the difference?
Well, a lot of people come and deliver curriculum. We are the curriculum. We walk it, we imbibe it, we live it. Mm-hmm. And from the minute we talk to somebody on the phone or on a virtual meeting or in our training, yeah, we have slides in our training. We're not reading slides. We're facilitating discussion. Mm-hmm. We're trying to do, you know, mindsets, trying to do mind shift, right? And then, but it's not just about our thinking, it's about our practice. And so we want people to really get it right there in the moment, but we want them to be able to practice, and we want them to be okay with struggling with that. We get follow-up calls all the time. I tried this and I struggled with it, or I made a mistake here. And it's like those ongoing conversations are actually more powerful. I mean, obviously the training is powerful, but it's not what happens in that room. It's what happens beyond that room.
Yeah.
And we want to be a part of that too. And that's where we've trained somebody 15 years ago, and now we talk to them on a regular basis.
Yep.
About their growth and their practice and the success they're having. And it shows up as they become teacher of the year, or they move into a director position or a coordinator position or a superintendent position, or they just figured out something at home with their family they've been struggling with for a long time. And the light bulb goes off, because it's not just about where we work. It's about people,
yeah,
where we live,
Because we also work outside of the context of public schools. You know, we work in foster care agencies, for example, and adult facilities for people with intellectual disabilities, residential programming, treatment centers, outpatient, inpatient, you name it. So you think about where this is needed, and it's needed everywhere in our society.
Yeah.
More and more things continue to be more troublesome in our society. And so when we think about what mindset is and what we do, David's actually absolutely right. We're trying to teach people a way of being. Way to be. And having said that, we're training trainers of our stuff. And I said, I was on the phone yesterday with David. We were both on our way home from meetings. And I said to him on the phone, do you realize we have over 2,000 trainers of mindset safety management out there right now in the nation? And those trainers are responsible anywhere from training 100 to maybe 300 or 400 people each. So exponentially, this message is growing across the nation, and we're exceptionally grateful.
I love it.
And I'm proud of that.
As it should. And as you should. Let me ask you guys, because what you're saying is that your curriculum is rooted in neuroscience and human development, which obviously is going to trickle down into successes, right? It when implemented correctly. And so how can you explain how that translates into everyday classroom strategies?
Well, when a student feels unsafe, or when a teacher feels unsafe, or when groups of students feel unsafe, the likelihood of dysregulated behavior is extremely high. What's dysregulated behavior really look like? And it looks from here to there in terms of the continuum of behavior. You know, kid walks in, maybe kicks a trash can over and says, F you and F this place. It's like, how do we respond? What's our gut tell us to do?
Yeah.
Our own neuroscience also gets involved as well, because we can be triggered by that.
Mm-hmm.
So the number one thing is for us to remain calm, aware, and respectful, and respond to that behavior non-judgmentally without the idea of punishment first. And that's really hard in a school culture.
Yes, it is.
But, you know, all I would say is, hey, man, I see you just kicked the trash can over. In that tone. I see you just kicked the trash can over. It seems like you're really angry right now. What's up? And then I call it this. As soon as we get the student or the person, it could be another teacher, to look at you and say, yeah.
Right.
You know, I call it evoking the yeah.
Nice.
If we can evoke the yeah, then we've come alongside of this person, then we can further the conversation when they're ready. Let's see, how many times do we push kids into corners because we're raised on our timeline rather than theirs?
Huh.
Yeah. I think a lot of the systems that we've developed and matrices that we've developed revolve around behavior, especially in schools, actually limit the options that adults have. And any human being, the less options they have, or when they have limited options, the chance for them to get dysregulated are higher. You know, nobody likes to feel trapped. And so one of the things that we explore is how many options do you have in this moment, and which ones do you feel confident about? And going back to that word safety that Steve used a minute ago, is it's the feeling of safety. That's what allows people to take chances and explore and be okay with the struggle so they can learn and grow. But, you know, we focus, everybody wants to talk about children's behavior. I agree, that's something we do want to talk about. But I think adult behavior is really fun to talk about with adults when the light bulb goes off, because they go, well, the way I grew up, or the way I was trained, or the way I was told to do this, and it's not working all the time. It's not working very well. We say the things that we say, and they go, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Maybe I can try that. And once they give it a shot, they recognize, you know what? I can take 3 minutes out of my day.
Yeah.
I can look at that kid and say, what do you need right now? And the kid might say, get the F away from me.
Yeah.
You know what our response is? Back away from them. Okay, when you're ready, you let me know. Instead of this, you know, you start pointing fingers of shame and blame at people, you know where that's going to go, right? That's what we've done for generations.
It is.
Think about this also. We're going to talk about old wisdom. You know, if you want people to be self-actualized, where does it actually begin? When you think of Maslow's hierarchy of need, right? Our basic needs. What are our basic needs? Well, we didn't want a long time about that, right? If you think about students walking into schools without their basic needs of belonging and safety being met, they may be hungry, they may be scared, they may be cold. They may have been in an environment where they're completely traumatized by their personal experiences.
Yeah.
And we're saying, put it down, pull your books out, and get to work.
Right.
Not working out so well.
You know, I got it. Go ahead, David. Go ahead, please.
No, I was saying, there's so much focus on academic achievement,
yes,
and attendance and graduation rates, and I'm not anti those things.
Sure,
I think they're very important. But all the good research out there shows that once we work on the social skills and behavioral teaching, mm-hmm. then the academic success follows.
Yeah,
it's just that sometimes we get so urgent, so rushed towards these academic metrics that we fail to do the thing that actually leads us to that place. And so oftentimes we'll tell people the work is too urgent to be rushed.
Yeah.
We can't force people to learn to read or do math, but what we can do is connect with them and help them feel safe enough to explore. And that's what we experience, you know, when we're working with kids in the classroom and we see evidence of it. As a matter of fact, one of our staff members was just working down at a school with a lot of tough kids, and just in 4 weeks has moved the needle. You know, I've been blowing up this morning with all the response from the work that she's been doing down there with our approach. And they don't just feel good about now. They feel good about the future and they're already talking about excitement about next fall in one of the toughest schools in that district. And so we've experienced it. We've lived it, but it continues to happen everywhere we go.
So, I mean, and that walks me right through my next question, because when a school decides to bring in mindset, right? And I ask this question because I see what you're talking about all over the place. I see these cultures. I see the blame game. I see the impact of a long school year, lack of pay, overwork, whatever the hell it is, right? You guys, like it's a number of reasons. When a school decides to bring in mindset, what does that rollout typically look like?
Well, it varies. It really varies, you know, depending upon those individual school districts' needs and those individual schools' needs. I'll say this, from the very beginning of this work, it was designed around the idea that safety meant holding kids when necessary to keep them safe because they were performing behaviors that were a danger to themselves or a danger to others.
Mm.
It evolved over time in a really good way to move away from that as being the primary focus. But many school systems have a safety intervention training program such as ours.
Uh-huh.
And you can, and the real difference between mindset's approach and those approaches is we function from the point of view where crisis is not inevitable.
Huh.
You know, it's not inevitable. We do need to train people to help children become safe when necessary. But what is safety?
Yeah.
And safety involves around the environments in which we experience our lives. So, you know, we're talking about things from a different angle, if you will. The school districts hire us to come in to train trainers.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Well, it means whatever they can do with it, you know, and our training is very cost effective because we're committed to building systems and processes, as David said this very well. We're there to build capacity,
mm-hmm.
and sustain. And so when you look at the cost structures of things, it's obvious that we want people to have many mindset trainers on staff, not just a few. And we've also developed another set of credentialed certifications, if you will, to train only part one of our curriculum, which is all about de-escalation,
okay.
culture and climate.
And I think we take that approach where we focus on tier one, you know, it's not the stuff that we talk about. It's not something that's secret to students. We want every human being working in every building, whether they're 3, 7, 16, 35, 50, to have an understanding of what this culture and climate could be and the language that helps. And I don't mean just verbal language, but, you know, physical body language, our movements, our settings, how we communicate, how that generates a responsive world that allows people to grow.
I'm firing questions at them and they are on the hot seat and it's time to get turn up the heat. So this question is a loaded one. So David, I'm going to start with you. A lot of times in a school culture, I'll see a lot of what we spoke about so far on the show. We have disgruntled students, disconnection with staff, a combination of burnout this time of year as well, everything else under the sun. One of the major reasons and factors that can contribute to a school culture could be the skepticism of veteran teachers or administrators who've seen it all, and they're not really hype on trying something new, going to new professional developments, et cetera, going that whole route. David, how do you address that skepticism? You know, because that's a tough one. So I'm going to throw that at you.
Yeah, I think it can be tough, but I think that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful to be a part of talking with Joe, the traveling principal, right? You asked this question, and I think it's, you talk about resistance and skepticism. Those are good things. You know, you got veteran teachers, you got leaders in schools, they should be trying to vet things. We have shifted over the years to really embracing that resistance. And quite frankly, resistance is generally one of the first responses to any change, mm-hmm. even a change that we agree upon. And so I really embrace that, and have really come to see that resistance is people processing what this is about, which is necessary for them to get to the place where they actually act upon it. And I think when we embrace that and make it okay for them to push back and ask questions, we actually get more buy-in. We don't, one of our guiding principles is avoiding power struggles. We don't spend a lot of time arguing with people. We spend a lot of time hearing people and helping them arrive to a place that's going to be good for them. Mm-hmm. Steve, how would you approach that set of questions?
Oh, thanks. I thought that was his question. I agree with David wholeheartedly, because you know, we talk about this within the context of our curriculum as well, how to deal with oppositional behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, because one of the ways I approach this when I'm working is like, how many of us as adults find ourselves displaying oppositional behavior?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's a natural outcome of thinking, a thought process, if you will. Excuse me. So oppositional behavior is also something that we need to look at through the lens of change. You know, how does anything change if nobody stands up for themselves? How does anything change if no one decides the way we're going is not okay, and I'm going to oppose that way, mm-hmm. because I think the better way, I may not know the better way yet, but this way's not working.
Yeah.
So let me just say, I'm opposed to this. I'm opposed to this way that we're moving. I'm going to stand here and say, we need to go a different way. That sparks conversation.
I like it.
But when we're working with students and students go, wait a minute, that's not right, that usually results in confrontation, because we're looking for compliance, right? So educators are bent on compliance to their organizational standards and their codes of conduct and everything else. But I worked back in the day in the mid-90s and early 2000s. I was a district-wide behavior intervention specialist, and I got a call one day from the special education director, who asked me if I would be willing to stay late in the evenings and open up an evening academy for the kids that got kicked out of school because they couldn't find enough homebound teachers to go into their homes to fill the obligations of IDEA. So I had kids coming to our alternative program in the evenings who were already expelled from school. And wow. I looked at some of these kids, I'm like, you know what? Most of you are on probation. And honestly, I can't make you do anything, but I would hope that you can accomplish some of these goals and maybe earn some credit toward graduation. And most of these students were nowhere near graduation. Mm-hmm. So what's my role now? I'm fulfilling the obligation of the school system's responsibility to say we provided X number of hours service for these students. Huh. So we opened every session by going up to the gym and playing basketball. Then we came back down, and then we started doing some work. And then they started opening up and talking with me about life and in general what's going on. And it was a good approach for those kids to find a sense of belonging that was not in the gang.
I have to say, I learned a Jedi skill from you guys, and you kind of just said it, and it ultimately boiled down to seeing the student, understanding them, listening to them, and acknowledging that I'm seeing them, right? So those are a bit of your four-step counseling model, but what tell my listeners, what does tier one coaching look like? in action when a school is struggling with behavior management, because you're already starting to go that way. Okay, you guys, so that's going to be part one of my interview with Steve and Dave. If you like that, stay tuned for part two, where we get into the discussion about tier one coaching and what that looks like through the mindset safety management perspective. In addition, I ask Steve and David specific questions about school culture and trauma-informed practices, which are starting to be something that I see as a need in all kinds of schools. We get into practical tips for the listeners when they're implementing mindset safety. So if you've been trained already, this might be pretty beneficial for you. So stay tuned for part two, where I throw Steve and David back on the hot seat, ask them all kinds of situational questions, and we learn how mindset safety management can shift the culture at your school.